There is no health without mental health. Greetings and welcome to Beyond Madness from me, your host, Professor Christopher Paul Sabo. I'm a psychiatrist and this podcast series is dedicated to the discipline of psychiatry, discussing issues that, whilst emanating directly from the discipline, have implications for society generally. The series engages thought leaders from within the discipline and beyond to assist in exploring these issues and providing insights into some of the thinking that contributes to the richness of psychiatry. Beyond Madness is proudly brought to you by Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave. Have you ever had a loved one or friend with a chronic condition, suffering, with no prospect of recovery, and they spoke of wanting to die, wishing for an end to their suffering? What if it were legally possible to assist them, to provide them with their wish? And if it was, when does possibility become obligation to end the burden of loved ones? Joining us for today's episode to discuss the difficult and emotive issue of assisted dying, I have with me Dr. Chris Verster and Professor Willem Landman, as well as a third guest who I will introduce later in the episode. Chris is currently the head of clinical unit at Worcester Regional Hospital. He has a Master's of Philosophy degree in Applied Ethics from the University of Stellenbosch, where he has served on the Health Research Ethics Committee for a number of years. Willem is a professor extraordinaire in philosophy at the University of Stellenbosch. He has studied philosophy, political philosophy, theology and law at the University of Stellenbosch, Oxford, as well as UNISA. He was formerly a professor of medical ethics at the University of North Carolina in the United States of America. He returned to South Africa to found the Ethics Institute. He's the founding CEO, and he's also an executive committee member of Dignity SA. Chris and Willem, once again, thanks for making the time to join us. Just a few opening words from me beyond the opening question. Death is a part of life. There's no escaping it. The transhumanists might have us morph into something potentially more than mortal beings, which is something seemingly no longer in the realms of science fiction, but that's a different topic for another day. As things stand, we all die, and hopefully along the way we have led virtuous and meaningful lives. Sometimes, though, the end is not a peaceful event, but a tortuous process of pain, suffering, and loss of dignity. Is it then reasonable for a rational person of sound mind to request an end, to request assistance with hastening death because for them there is no prospect of life worth living? And maybe by the end of this episode we'll have an answer. Certainly, I'm sure we will have opinions. Willem, I'm going to start with you, and I think it's very important to set the legal framework. And so I'm going to ask you if you could potentially give us a brief overview of what one might call end-of-life choices, what they are and what their legal status is in South Africa.
Thank you, Christopher. I'm going to be brief, and you may wish to take up some of these points that I want to make. Our common law says that physician-assisted suicide, as well as voluntary active euthanasia, are crimes. They're crimes of murder. Obviously, the facts of the crimes have to be established. In opposition to that, since 1996, our constitution introduced a number of rights. I think I can think of four key rights that I would argue support a right to assisted dying. In other words, both physician-assisted suicide and voluntary active euthanasia.
I think what's important there is that assisted dying encompasses assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia. And one must make the distinction?
That's an important question. I don't think, from a number of points of view, I don't think there's a serious distinction to be made. But right. The fact is that certain jurisdictions legalize some of them and some both of them.
Right.
Or one of them and others both of them. Now, what is interesting is that the cases we've had where somebody's been sentenced for murder or found guilty of murder and then had to be sentenced, is that the courts were reluctant to impose imprisonment, right. a jail sentence. That's what happened to Sean Davison, but also 46 years ago to Dr. Albie Hartmann, who was a GP in Ceres,
right.
And actually euthanized his father, octogenarian, suffering unbearably from cancer. He was sentenced to the rising of the court. So there's been an unease, a reluctance on the part of our law courts to really sentence people found guilty of murder in this instance, you know, a sister dying.
So I suppose there we're talking about how judges might interpret the act in terms of how they pass sentence.
You see, they have latitude in terms of sentence.
Right.
Unfortunately, we have a minimum sentence as introduced not so long ago, which wasn't the case in 1975 with Judge Louis van Vinsen in the Hartman case.
Right.
But they had to find them guilty. Sean Davison had to be found guilty in terms of our law, and the same with Dr. Hartman.
Right.
But the discomfort, the unease was actually discounted in the jail sentence. Now, Sean didn't have a light sentence, but it was certainly not 14 years in jail.
Incarceration in jail.
Incarceration.
Absolutely. Right.
So we have the common law, which says these are crimes. We have the Constitution.
Right.
Which sets out these rights. Then we have the problem of sentencing. And the third, or the fourth I want to say is that, you know, in the Supreme Court of Appeal, five judges of appeal said that there's a deficiency in our law, precisely right. because of this tension between the common law and the Constitution, that will be remedied if a proper case comes to the court. So we suspend it in mid-air, as it will.
Right. So we're in no man's land.
Yeah.
Actually, and I think as you highlight, there is the Constitution, and basically my understanding was always, and this is what I've seen certainly coming from a background of psychiatry with the Mental Health Care Act, where every law is supposed to be rewritten within the context of the new constitution. Now, obviously, there is this tension in terms of how law is practiced. And the question I think that is being alluded to here or being raised is it being practiced in harmony with the constitution
exactly.
as it stands?
Exactly.
Because if we look at constitutional rights in terms of the right to dignity, the right to bodily integrity, you know, where does that fit into what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, you make a very important point that since 1996, we've had various social rights being recognized, socioeconomic rights, labor rights, termination of pregnancy, right to have one's pregnancy terminated, same-sex unions, abolition of capital punishment. So in a sense, what we're talking about here with a sister dying is the last right. And the last right, R-I-T-E, that hasn't been, fully reviewed in terms of the Constitution, or not reviewed at all in terms of the Constitution.
And yet there seem to me that there have been efforts to actually remedy this in
yes.
law, but always kind of going a little bit of the way, but not getting there, and then kind of like disappearing like water in a desert into the sand.
The Stransom Ford case was, was taken to on appeal.
Right.
But it was upheld. So the court said that they want a proper case that all the arguments should be put on the table.
Okay, so this for me was a bit perplexing. What is a proper case? How do you define a proper case?
I don't think that's the term they use, but what they said, all the arguments must be put on the table.
Well, they're looking for a specific case, it seems to me, that will in some way bring everything together where they can make a definitive decision.
You see, the Stransom Ford case was an application which was specific to Stransom Ford.
Right.
And the argument was that not all the arguments were put on the table at the Supreme Court of Appeal. And they want the advocates on both sides to flesh out all the arguments for and against changing the law to accommodate a sister dying.
Are they looking for a case that doesn't exist? Because in a sense, I mean, you're saying, okay, we've gone, all the arguments must be encapsulated in one case so that it can be fully fleshed out, debated, decided. Does that case exist? I mean, how do you define what that case is going to be?
Well, we get you. You're right. We have different cases. But what they probably want to know is, is the person competent? Is the request autonomous? Is it made freely? Is it on the basis of a medical condition that is intractable?
Right.
Produces suffering that's unbearable.
Right.
And irreversible. So all of those aspects they want to,
so they're
to
looking
be put on the table.
Okay, so they're looking for specific criteria.
Exactly.
Which would be part and parcel of a specific case that each one can be looked at and debated and argued, should
exactly.
I say, not so much debated.
Exactly. And there is a case at the moment that's slowly winding its way through the courts. The problem is that your applicant is always somebody, or is mostly somebody, who has a terminal illness and cannot survive.
Well, Strantham Ford died before the judgment.
2 hours before.
Although maybe you can just elaborate slightly on that case. Are you able to do that?
Yeah, very briefly.
Yes.
Strantham Ford requested to be legally assisted with dying. He was suffering from cancer. And the appeal was, or the case was heard in the North Gauteng High Court in Pretoria. And the interesting thing was that the day was set aside for that. But the Minister of Health, opposing this application by Strantham Ford, wanted a day's grace to consult with the minister. And in that time, between late afternoon, when the judge wanted to make his ruling, and the next morning, Strantham Ford died. So in a sense, the case was moot. So
he didn't benefit from the judgment.
He didn't benefit from the judgment.
But that judgment stands as precedent.
No, it was overturned on appeal.
That's what I'd understood.
But that's when the court says, when the Supreme Court of Appeal said, we want to reflect on this. We want to think about this on the basis of all the arguments that I put on the table. But the court also made a very important point that if a proper case should come to the court, it is not for the court to write the law. That only Parliament can do. So what the court would do would be what had been done in Canada. The court would say to Parliament, here is a problem in our law, that there's a tension here, there's an inconsistency that has to be rectified, and this is your duty as lawmakers, Parliament, you should rectify the situation. And the court foresaw that might happen one day, or would happen one day.
So I think that's a very important point, which people don't necessarily understand, is that courts simply interpret the law, but it's Parliament that writes the law.
Yes.
So if there are going to be changes to the law, it's got to come through Parliament.
Exactly.
And I think that's key in terms of who we lobby, ultimately. If one is inclined to want laws, you have to go through those channels.
Yeah, but you see, unless a court, like the Supreme Court of Appeal or the Constitutional Court, tells Parliament that you have a duty, you have a moral duty and a legal duty to do something about this, nothing will happen, because we have that report that President Mandela commissioned, and the report came out in 1998 about end-of-life choices, which also included assisted dying.
Right.
And that report also included a draft legislation.
But it didn't go anywhere.
Didn't go anywhere. It was on Monte Shabalala's, Msimang's desk for 10 years, and nobody's done anything. So I'm not very optimistic about going to Parliament and tell them this is your duty. They won't do anything. I mean, it's a dysfunctional body in other respects anyway. So, and you know, the point is that dying people are not a pressure group or a group with political power, unlike women, and termination of pregnancy.
Right. So, I mean, so that's a very interesting point, because the truth of the matter is, and I think that's where Dignity SA comes in terms of death with dignity. I do think that that's everybody wants to die a dignified death. Mm. So in that sense, everybody has a vested interest, I would say, because we all die. So we don't all necessarily seek abortions, but we all definitely die.
And we don't know how we will die.
Correct.
We may die a gentle death and in peace, or violently and suddenly in a car crash, but we do not know whether we will die in the fashion that Strantham Ford died.
So I think people don't necessarily think sufficiently about their death for it to be an issue for them.
Precisely.
Until something happens where they are confronted with a situation where they now have to reflect on this. Because I would say to you, wow, we've got the entire population. Yeah. That's the biggest lobbying group possible.
But they don't think about it.
Exactly. So my question is it how it's portrayed? Is it how it is understood in the general public as actually this is an issue which is not for a selected few suffering people, because but by the grace of God, that could be you.
Christopher, I have appeared on programs like these for more than 25 years, yes. And I find that there has been a change. It's not a scientific observation that I make. It's an anecdotal observation, but judging by how people write in the media, on social media, which is something that we didn't have 25 years ago, judging in terms of responses to newspaper articles, radio programs, there's a far greater understanding, and there's overwhelming support. But obviously this support comes from people who have a radio and take the trouble of phoning in or making comments. So I'm not suggesting that if we have a referendum, the majority of South Africans would support this. But I think there's been a shift. But for that matter, I think the evidence that we have, the majority of South Africans do not support termination of pregnancy. And with the violence that we have, actually do support capital punishment. But the question is not how the majority feels. Mm. It is what does the Constitution, in terms of our rights, say is legal.
Right. So we didn't cover the other end-of-life choices, but just for being comprehensive, there's end-of-life pain management, which can lead to death if one uses excessive analgesia. So that's one possibility. There's refusal of and refraining from life-sustaining treatment. That's another one. And then, of course, advanced directives. Now, each one of these is a whole separate entity in and of themselves. But the one that we are really focused on is the fourth one, which is the assisted dying.
If I could just add, those others were incorporated in the report that I of the South African Law Commission, which President Mandela commissioned. And they even failed, Parliament even failed to address them. And what we get now, I think, we have a lot of undermanagement of pain because of fear of patients dying too soon, and legal liability that follows from that. Yes. Withdrawal of care, I think there's over-treatment with withdrawal and withholding of care, also for legal reasons of legal liability. So they could have been addressed, and they were addressed in the report, but we haven't made any progress with that. And then obviously, advanced directives. People are uncertain about the legal status of a living will,
and that is basically where you, in advance, in a competent state of mind, say, "If this were to happen, this is what I would like to happen.
Do not treat me; just let me die."
So, I think one of the key issues in each of these options is the one of competence, and I think I'm going to bring Chris in shortly to discuss that issue, because who assesses competence and what is competence in terms of how you understand things, how you reason, how you communicate, and how consistent is your, how capable are you of making those decisions. So I think competence is a very important component in each of these choices.
I think so. The important thing to realize about competence, I think, is that it is task relative. A kid can be competent to choose vanilla ice cream rather than chocolate ice cream.
Right.
But here the competence is about, are you competent to decide about the continuation of your life or the ending of your own life? So that's a particular benchmark, and we have to look at reasoning and all the aspects of that, how we assess that.
So another component or other components of which go beyond competence is the issue around autonomy and no coercion. Because one of the arguments that has been used against is that if it's legally possible, when does it become an obligation to actually end your life to ease the burden of suffering of others around you?
In jurisdictions where we have assisted dying that's been legalized, the important aspect is that it must be initiated by the person who wants to die. That's a baseline, and it must be a free request in terms of your chosen values. It mustn't be just a haphazard thing that happens, pops up one day. It must form a pattern and must tie in with your chosen values over a period of time. So that's where the safeguards would actually look at that. Is the request based in a kind of illness that's serious, that's and with suffering, and does it Is it consistent with the patient's chosen values? And is the request repeated, etc.?
So it's a process.
It's a process, and the patient must be given the chance to rescind the choice.
Yes, because I think that can happen, obviously. I think one of the other tensions is what the law might decide versus what a professional body might decide. So the courts may say, well, we find you not guilty, or we find you guilty of murder, and we sentence you to whatever the sentence would be. You serve your time, you're done, but your professional body says, we take you off the register.
It's exactly what happened to Dr. Hartmann. The judge didn't want to sentence him to jail. He sentenced him to the rising of the court, so that when the judge left the courtroom, Hartmann was set free. But his professional body scrapped him.
So that's another tension that has to be addressed. How do professional bodies view the same act versus how the courts might?
Well, I think if it's decriminalized, then the professional body can't go against that. Then that tension will be resolved.
Okay, so that's a key issue.
Yeah.
It's the decriminalization,
yes,
which would then resolve that tension and actually would resolve a lot of the tensions that we have.
Exactly.
So I wanted to raise one other issue briefly. And because I saw that the Minister of Health's response or argument against assisted dying was palliative care.
Yes.
So we can give palliative care, so why do we need to hasten the end?
Well, I mean, obviously palliative care varies. So let's assume it's optimal. Let's assume it's perfect. We live in an ideal world. You still have to go through a period where you have to receive medicine, where you feel uncomfortable, where you feel, you know, managing my pain and my suffering is degrading. It's a way, I don't want this to continue. So the argument there would be that it's somebody's personal choice,
yes,
not to die in that way with palliative care that drags out, you know, that could drag out the dying process, for argument's sake, another two weeks.
So that's a critical issue. Mm. It's a personal choice.
Personal choice.
The fact that palliative care is available doesn't mean that I necessarily have to comply or to participate in that level of care.
I think palliative care is enormously important.
Of course. Of course.
It is non-negotiable.
Yeah.
But for some patients, they may be in the progression of their disease, their illness. There comes a point where you say, I don't want it any longer.
Yes.
Just remove this. Not only remove, stop it, but end it for me. Help me to end this. And it's their personal choice. And those who don't want to make that choice don't have to.
No, absolutely.
That's the wonderful thing.
Yes.
It is a personal choice.
There's no coercion. So, Willem, I'm going to shift from you to Chris, and I'm going to go from the general to the specific, and specifically psychiatry. So, obviously, the issue of assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide, you know, when psychiatrists hear the word suicide, it kind of raises red flags. And obviously, there are two aspects that I really wanted to look at, because the one is where psychiatry fits into, let me call it assisted dying, within the context of a terminal physical illness, and then within the context of something which is emerging within the context of a mental illness, which I think is something which is not brand new, but it's certainly emerging in more recent times. So, Chris, I wanted to ask your thoughts on, for example, assisted dying and this whole issue, and this is within the context of a terminal physical illness, and the issue of competence. Does psychiatry have a role to play there?
I think psychiatry definitely does. And some of the countries which allow for assisted dying would actually require at least one or two psychiatrists to be involved in the assessment.
Right.
And the problem with competency is that it can change over time. So obviously somebody who has a serious terminal illness, as the illness progresses, they might very well come a time when the person is no longer able to competently make these decisions for him or herself.
Right.
But also,
so that's a problem, right? Because at a certain point, you're competent, and maybe when you most need to be able to make that decision, you are deemed incompetent, and therefore the decision can't be made.
Yeah, so that brings the issue of something like an advance directive.
Right.
So when you know what will most likely happen to you, should that not be the time that you should make this decision, and then that should be a sort of a binding decision.
Yes.
The problem also is with, one can assume that for any person who considers a request for assisted dying, there must be quite extensive emotional trauma, emotional issues that they would be going through. And then this raises the issue of psychiatric conditions like depression, etc.,
right.
Which by itself then can impact on your ability to make a, I don't want to use the word truly autonomous decision, because I don't believe there is something like a truly autonomous decision, but it can impact on your decision-making processes.
Right.
And in the literature, it has been described that people may have good reasons and can make good arguments for requesting a process of assisted dying. And then even with progression of a terminal illness, this changes over time.
Right.
Maybe a month or three later, they feel that maybe this is not what they would want. So it really is complicated to make these decisions. And my opinion is that it should never just be a once-off decision. It should be a process.
Yes. I think that's exactly what I'd said earlier to Willem, so I'm in complete agreement with that. And I mean, just in terms of depressive symptomatology potentially influencing one's inclination towards physician-assisted suicide, there does seem to be a link. And so therefore, the psychiatric involvement would be to make sure that the decision is not based on the presence of such symptomatology, which could influence a decision. What would your thoughts be there?
Yeah, I think so. It also raises the question when one talks about terminal illnesses, what is a terminal psychiatric illness?
Okay, so that's that's going to be something which I wanted to touch on, because obviously, you know, we're speaking specifically now within the context of a physical illness, but what I'm seeing is the emergence of this move into psychiatry. And there the question would be, what is a terminal illness in terms of psychiatry? So it seems to me that there is a move towards physician-assisted suicide, certainly in the Netherlands, from what I've seen, being something which is available for psychiatric patients and something which, to a limited extent, but certainly it has been pursued. So I think that's where our conversation is going next, which is to now psychiatric patients who do not have a physical terminal illness. What are your thoughts there, where we talk about physician-assisted suicide?
I think on the one hand, one should maybe consider moving away from using the word illness and talk about terminal suffering.
Right.
Because I think one of the first sort of worldwide well-known cases where psychiatric reasons for assisted dying was presented was in the early 90s in Belgium. Psychiatrist with a very Belgian name, Boudewijn Chabot.
Right.
He requested the right to be for assisted dying for one of his patients, who actually he found that she did at that stage not have a diagnosable psychiatric illness, but the emotional suffering that she was undergoing because of I think she was a single parent and both her sons had died, and there was just no sense in her continuing with her life anymore, even though you could not formally make a psychiatric diagnosis. So the emphasis moved away from the potential illness rather than she is in a state of constant suffering. And I think people would probably or mostly find that difficult to equate physical suffering to emotional suffering. I mean, it's relatively easy to understand that somebody with terminal cancer, metastases, etc., chronic pain, the severe pain, etc., how bad that suffering must be. But then to compare that to emotional suffering, I think it's generally a difficult thing to do, but we cannot ignore that, because emotional suffering, people are really suffering. And if this is a persistent state, then your quality of life is virtually nothing.
Well, I think that's very important, because, I mean, for any diagnosis to be made in psychiatry, using the DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the fifth version, suffering is a component. And, you know, the person must be suffering, and of course they must have impaired functioning. So quality of life is definitely impacted. So I think virtually every psychiatric condition, if you're going to make the diagnosis, has these criteria or has these qualifiers in order to make the diagnosis. So I think certainly in psychiatry, suffering is something which is across the board. I think what you're saying is people can't necessarily relate to the extent of suffering that might lead someone to say, I would like my life to end. But of course, there is suicide. And so psychiatric patients do suffer to the point where they attempt and succeed in terms of killing themselves. So I think that speaks volumes for the kind of suffering that one might experience with a psychiatric illness. Your thoughts there, Chris?
Yeah, and it's interesting that all psychiatrists would feel very strongly that, yes, we can empathize with somebody who decides that suicide is the only option out. And, I mean, there are criteria for something called rational suicide as well. But the question then is, does that differ so much from somebody who requests assistance?
Yes.
Maybe. And I think, as far as I remember, that was one of the arguments that Dr. Chabot had with his patient. He said that he'd known her for a long time, and if she decides to go and commit suicide by herself, it's a very lonely, isolated process. And he felt that in that stage of her life, or during that decision-making process, he would not want to desert her. He wanted to be there with her.
Right. So, I mean, we're starting to see cases where physician-assisted suicide is approved in certain jurisdictions, certain countries. And so we have to accept that this is a phenomenon that exists. I think for us as psychiatrists and within the context of our discipline, the question is how comfortable we feel with facilitating something which we spend a lot of time trying to prevent.
Yeah, I think in the broader context as well, I think you would find many, many doctors who have an understanding and sympathy of the whole issue of requesting assisted dying, but to actually be involved in the process, it is much more difficult. And I think for psychiatrists as well, it's one thing to say that I understand that my patient really feels that there's no sense in living anymore, but I don't necessarily want to be the one who helps him or her. And that's something that we need to talk about.
Yes. And I think the other issue for me is that people can change their minds, and certainly mental state changes. So one must be careful that a moment of despair doesn't lead to a final decision about life or death, because at the end of the day, things can change. Treatment options evolve. There's a natural history of illness, as we know in psychiatry. So I think one has to be a little bit cautious, I think, when it comes to psychiatry. I don't know what your thoughts are, Chris.
Yeah, I think you know that when one starts talking about something like treatment-resistant depression,
right,
you would always have somebody who would say, but have you tried this? Have you considered going up to this sort of mega dosage of a specific drug? So there will always be somebody with a next suggestion.
Right.
But there are criteria for truly resistant depression, and I think maybe that is one of the most important things, that if the legislation is to go ahead, there would have to be clear guidelines as
right.
to if you were to consider psychiatric reasons for assisted dying, the criteria would have to be very, very, very well documented and defined.
Yes. So when Willem walked into the studio earlier, he said there'd been some news coming out of Canada in terms of psychiatric patients and assisted dying. Willem, do you just want to mention it briefly and Chris can comment?
Yeah, very, very briefly. The Canadian Penal Code said that in order to, or Criminal Code,
yes.
said in order to qualify for assisted dying, you have to, and I quote, you have to have a grievous and irremediable medical condition. Now, that was interpreted since 2015 as meaning that you must have a physical illness.
Right.
Psychiatric patients only qualified if they had a comorbidity, if they had also had a physical illness.
Right.
In other words, a terminal illness. What has happened now, the Canadians have argued that this is inconsistent with what the Criminal Code said, and that you cannot discriminate against mental patients, psychiatric patients. So they've constituted a panel who submitted their report 2 weeks ago, an expert panel, and there's a sunset clause. From the 17th of March next year, 2023, psychiatric patients, mental patients suffering from only a psychiatric or mental illness will qualify. Right. So they do not need a comorbidity that's a physical illness. So they're looking at how should they introduce this. They're looking at safeguards and protocols, etc.
Okay. So, Chris, there seems to be quite a shift in that sense.
Yeah, I think, as far as I remember, that's also what happened in the Netherlands. Initially, yes. it was allowed for physical illnesses, but not for psychiatric illnesses. But over time, that changed. So although it's still a small percentage that is allowed, I think, you can now apply for assisted dying,
yes,
based on psychiatric.
Belgium also.
So I think that this is an issue which, as psychiatry, we are going to have to face, and we're going to have to engage with and have rational discussions about how we want to position ourselves. Because if it is available, not in our jurisdiction, but in other jurisdictions, at some point it may well become relevant in the local setting. And obviously we're going to need to be prepared as a discipline in terms of how we're going to engage, Chris. So that's why I think these discussions might not be immediately relevant, but I think they're important for what's coming over the hill, so to speak. Now, I want to bring my third guest in, but before I do, I just want to mention something that I came across in the April British Medical Journal, where they were looking, this was the United Kingdom Office for National Statistics. And what they were saying was that completed suicide amongst terminally ill patients not granted permission for assisted dying was double that of the general population. So if not granted, it seems that the patient may well proceed anyway. So I think that's very important. And what the piece was arguing for was for a change in UK legislation, that it's time for reform. So with that piece of information out there, I want to bring in our third guest. He's been sitting quietly listening to this conversation. And our third guest is Sean Davison. Now, Sean is a professor in the Department of Biotechnology at the University of the Western Cape. And he recently published a book, The Price of Mercy, A Fight for the Right to Die with Dignity, which is now available in bookshops. I saw it over the weekend, and provides an account of Sean's journey, his belief in the right to die with dignity, his involvement in rendering assistance based on his belief, serving various periods of house arrest, having been found guilty of murder in rendering such assistance, and most recently having served a 3-year sentence here in South Africa, having previously served a 5-month sentence in New Zealand. Now, Sean founded the organization Dignity SA in 2012. So, Sean, I want to welcome you and thanks for agreeing to join us. I think it's been a profoundly personal beginning to this journey that you've undertaken. And so I really just want to open the floor to you for reflections on the conversation and reflections on your journey. So I'm not going to tackle you with any specific questions. I'm going to open the floor to you and we'll take it from there.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And I can add that I co-founded Dignity SA with Willem Landman. I could not have done this without him. A brilliant mind, very, very lucky to have him. I'd like to go straight to the crux of the matter with the three men I helped to die. And it's very important to note that anyone can commit suicide at any time, if you're able. The three men I helped to die were totally incapable of ending their own life. And the bottom line is, if they could have done it on their own, they would have done it on their own. And if everyone understood that, I probably wouldn't have been arrested or gone to court. In effect, for Dr. Anik Berger, he was a quadriplegic. He planned his own death. He wrote a prescription for phenobarbital, which you can obtain in South Africa. He went to the chemist with his caregiver, right, and up to the pharmacy, and collected the prescription. I was only there at the very end to be his hands. And really, it certainly isn't murder. It's barely assisted suicide. I had to provide.
So, in other words, you were there to provide comfort at the end, more than physically participate in what he ultimately did.
Yeah, I can. Well, on that comfort note, he would have liked to have had more comfort, but the people he wanted to comfort him opposed him ending his life. His family. Well, not his immediate family supported him, his mother, but he had other friends around him and medical doctors all trying to stop him ending his own life, trying to convince him to want to live. And what he really wanted them to do is, hey, Anurag, I understand you, and I'm going to be with you at the end.
It sounds to me that this was a man in possession of all of his faculties. He was completely rational. He did not suffer from any comorbid psychiatric condition, because they seem to want it the other way around for psychiatric patients, or had wanted it the other way around, that they've got to have a comorbid physical condition. He had no psychiatric condition, and in clear consciousness and consistently, he had said, I've had enough. This is not a way to live. This is not the life that I would wish on anyone, and I don't want it for myself, and I am going to plot, plan, and implement my own demise. So therefore, the question for me is, how on earth, and I'm not a lawyer, did it amount to murder on your part?
Yeah, very good question. Also keep in mind, he was given the green light to go to Dignitas. That green light period had lapsed and he had to reapply for it. And then he got very worried. He said he's so worried that he has to have a psychiatric report and he might not get it this time, because when you want to end your life, the psychiatrist will say there's something wrong with you. And again, we come to the point, more medication, right. More blah, blah, blah. Okay. He didn't want any more medication. Only he could decide whether his life was worth living. And in his opinion, it wasn't worth living. He didn't want to be sitting in his wheelchair watching lives go on around
him. So I think one of the difficult issues is how a medical professional who spends their life saving lives can get their head around the fact that somebody in clear consciousness rationally says, I've had enough. Let me go. And could you please provide me with what I need to actually help me on my way? So I think that often is potentially a major stumbling block. Is the potentially? I'm not saying it is, but is it that the medical profession themselves cannot get their heads around the fact that this is a rational decision or a rational request?
I think it goes beyond the medical profession. We're all wired to live, and we live each day to the full, not thinking about what is going to happen at the end. And that's only a natural human reaction. I don't hold it against anybody. But when you are exposed to it, usually it's with a parent or elderly grandparent dying, and you see how difficult their death is, only then do you become aware of it and start thinking about it and how your death might be. And it comes to the very first point you raised in this discussion, people not being aware of the issue, not talking about it. And by having a conversation now, it's actually helping.
Well, I'd like to think so, because I think it's an issue that's not going to go away. And I think it's an issue that is very real. It's very current. And obviously, you know, with the release of your book and with your release from house arrest, I would imagine that there will be many more discussions like this. But you've spoken about one particular individual. I know that there were three in relation to the house arrest that you were sentenced to in South Africa. The other two cases, how did they differ from the one that you described?
Well, Justin, let's go to Richard Holland first. He was in a similar condition to Dr. Anna Berger, but worse. He could only move one eyelid and one thumb to communicate. It's referred to as locked-in syndrome. Only 30 years old, a very intelligent man, a wealthy family. He had all the treatments available in the world, but he wanted to die. He realized there was no hope of recovery, and he didn't want to spend the rest of his life moving a thumb and an eyelid. But he's able to communicate quite clearly with alphabet boards.
And in that particular situation, how were you involved, which ultimately led to the conviction?
I was contacted because my name was in the media and they'd heard of Dignity SA. I was the first approached for advice on how he could do it when he couldn't swallow and what medicines were available. And yeah, one thing led to another, and eventually I was present at his death, which led to murder.
Within the context of the second case that you've described, again, I'm understanding that your role was much more of a facilitator. You facilitated more than actively participated in the ending of life. Am I correct?
Yeah. I did facilitate the medication, providing it, and the delivering of it, which was why it led to a murder conviction. The reason I did that is because I was with his mother, who had clearly supported his death after doing everything possible to find joy in his life.
Oh, sure.
And she didn't want to lose her son. And at the very end, I could understand her not being the one to want to administer the lethal medication. It was me feeling compassion for the mother.
So you administered, Sean, is that correct? So
I did, yeah.
I mean, this is a very direct question now, because, I mean, I've been present, and I'm not equating humans to animals, but I've been present where I've had to euthanize various of my cats, and I've always wanted to be present, and I've watched that injection, and I've seen the life seep out of them with a sigh, and they go, and it's peaceful. It's a very profound moment, though. It's a very and it's been the vet who's been administering. I've simply been observing. And so my question to you, and I suppose you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but when you actually administer and you're there and you're watching life ebb out of the person in front of you, what is that experience, Sean? Because I've certified people dead as a medical doctor. I've seen people die. But this is something quite different in my experience. And so could you share your experience? I mean, your thoughts, your feelings in that moment.
Okay. Keep in mind, it was a moment that built up over many weeks and months beforehand. It wasn't a spontaneous decision, I'm going to help someone to die. I deliberated for a long time and thought about not doing it. And I thought about doing it and the consequences of doing it. So when the time came, I was mentally prepared, and it did take mental preparation. It's not instinctive.
No, not at all. And I think that's why I'm thinking about the psychological consequences for you. As much as you have a firm belief in the dignity of life and the dignity of death and the right to choose, I'm thinking about what the psychological consequence would be for you. And I'm not forgetting that this journey began back in 2010 in New Zealand with your mom.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the bottom line that I'm a human being, and we are all human beings, and it's in our nature not to turn our back on human suffering. It's a hallmark of humanity not to turn our backs. And we only need to look at the battlefields where your soldier beside you, guts open, dying miserably, will be begging for help, and you will help your soldier on the battlefield. And it's a bit like that. We don't turn our backs on human suffering.
So what I'm understanding, Sean, is that your compassion, in a sense, is more powerful than any sense of possible regret that you may have. And what I'm understanding is that you feel comfortable with what you've done because of your belief and because of your compassion and your humanity, because that's really what you're saying.
I have no regrets. And at the moment of the death, I felt the relief of the person who was dying, and particularly in Richard Holland's case. Lock-in syndrome at 30, and the tragedy of the accident, knocked off a bicycle. The whole process was dreadfully tragic. And yeah, I felt for his relief.
And you felt comfortable, and you felt a sense of relief yourself that his suffering was now over. Could you relate to that as well?
Yeah, it was a combination of that relief and the tragedy of a 30-year-old knocked off his bicycle, knowing it could happen to anybody, a combination of relief and tragedy.
Sean, I mean, obviously you've been, I'm going to use the word punished in inverted commas, in terms of the law. How has it impacted on you in terms of broader society? Have you experienced any isolation or any stigma or any negative sentiments towards you as a consequence of your involvement in these cases?
No, on the contrary, overwhelming support everywhere I've been, and Willem's been following some blogs, very, very strong support. I know there will be people opposed to it. But ultimately, when the law changes, it's not forced on anybody. It is only an option. And my feeling, and I think Willem will agree, the mood of the country is overwhelming for a law
change. Now, you had a close relationship with the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu. What were his thoughts, actually, in terms of your involvement with Dignity SA and where you were coming from?
When he first supported me is when I was arrested in New Zealand, and he was the chancellor of my university. He didn't know me individually. I was another professor at the university, but he did write the court asking that I'd be allowed back to my home country, South Africa, until the trial. Then I got to know him. And when I first met him to thank him for what he did, he said he'd never thought about assisted dying or euthanasia. And over the coming years, he really, really opened his mind to the idea. And he went public initially to say he supported the idea. It was in an article in The Guardian in the UK. And then in 2016, came out and said he would like an assisted death if the situation arose, if he needed it. Incredible for a man, a leader of the church and a follower of African ancestral religions to come out and say that. And when he spoke,
I'm sure that was the case, and I'm sure that that is the case. And I think the fact that he endorsed what you stood for is a very powerful testament to you know, where the situation is. Can you tell me just a little bit about Dignity SA? I know that you're the co-founder, but I've got you in front of me now. And so can you tell me a little bit about Dignity SA? Because I think that it's not necessarily an organization that is as well known as it might be. And I think we have an opportunity just to get a sense of what it's all about and where things are at with the organization.
We're very focused on the law change with the safeguards that right. Willem Landman has mentioned. And as Willem said, going through Parliament is a difficult route to take, but ultimately it has to be done in Parliament, as happened in Canada. The route we're taking now is through a particular applicant going to the High Court, Dieter Haak, seeking an assisted death for his motor neuron disease, or the option of having it. He might not take it, right. But he wants to have the option. We may not succeed, and then it will go to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And if we don't succeed there, we will go to the Constitutional Court this time. And Willem has quite very clear ideas of what might happen at the Constitutional Court. And should we succeed there, then the Court and Parliament are on different pages, and the Court will instruct Parliament to change the law. But maybe Willem might like to comment on the prospect of succeeding at the Constitutional Court.
Well, the interesting thing is we talked about the Stransom Ford case,
right.
that the appeal was upheld. In other words, we lost. But I had at least one Constitutional Court judge said to me afterwards that he was disappointed that he didn't come to the Constitutional Court.
Right.
So there was a sense that it could have been different. But, you know, it costs money, and
sure.
advocates, pro deo advocates had to be, you know, in on it.
Well, I think that what I'm hearing, without holding anybody to their word, is that there would be a certain, they'd be receptive to hearing such a case. Sean, I've got to ask you a difficult question. I mean, given everything that you've been through, and given now that you're a free man, so to speak, you've served your time, would you consider a further case, or would you hold off whilst you pursue legal routes to kind of try to get this resolved in a way that then will ensure that any further such involvement would not lead to criminal charges?
I do not want to go to court. I do not want to be right. charged with murder again.
Yes.
I've got a young family. They want a father, not a hero sitting in jail. I know it's a fine line between being courageous and being foolhardy. And I now know how
I think that you've walked the walk. And I think that's what's so important. You know, myself, Chris, Willem, we can talk about the theory of it in a sense and the ethics of it. But I think that in you, we have someone who's actually stepped across that line. And without being a medical person, you've engaged in doing something which none of us can actually attest to. So you've certainly walked the walk. And I think now what I'm understanding is, from a pragmatic point of view and from a self-preservation point of view, you've kind of understood, okay, been there, done that. We'll see what the future holds, but there's another path that I have to walk in order to get to that point. Would that be?
Christopher, can I come in on this? It's very dangerous out there.
Yes.
I understand fully what Sean is saying. Just consider this.
Yes.
The time that lapsed between Andrich Berger's death.
Yes, back then.
Back then, and Sean's arrest was 5 years.
Right.
And there are sinister forces at work. It's dangerous out there, and I support Sean in his choice in this regard. He has to be careful.
No, absolutely, because I think that's really what I'm getting to is that there's a certain pragmatism that has to prevail ultimately. You've had the experience, you understand what the implications are. It's time to step back and take a different route. Would I be correct in that?
My news will disappear, but there'll be another case. It won't be mine, and another. And another. This will keep on coming back again and again until it is dealt with compassionately by the law.
I think that's a very important understanding, and I think it's a good place to close today's discussion. Willem, any further comments, or Chris, any comments from you? No closing.
Just briefly, I think the cases, you know, the patients Sean helped illustrate to us. The problem of simply legalizing a physician-assisted suicide and not voluntary euthanasia, because there are people who are unable to commit suicide. In fact, the Supreme Court said that if we come to legalizing or decriminalizing, we come to that stage, we'll have to look at equality rights. So some people would blame Sean for actually actively helping rather than, you know,
providing
the means. Yes. Which the patient then self-administers. But it's impossible for some patients to do that, and there's an issue of equality and discrimination.
So that's where the distinction between physician-assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia is important, because the one is not active in terms of the person helping, whereas the other is.
The real difference is that the final act may be that of the patient or of somebody else.
Correct. And what we're saying is actually all should be decriminalized.
Exactly.
I think that's where we are. So, Chris, Willem, Sean, I said before the episode, I think I've got 3 separate episodes in one podcast, because I think that there are many, many issues that we could probably discuss much further. But I think what's important is that we've put the issue out there, and I think it's going to provoke thought. I don't know what action will follow, but obviously through Dignity SA, there is a process that will hopefully unfold. So I'm not sure that today's episode has provided definitive answers to the vexing questions related to end-of-life decisions, but at the very least, I believe it has placed in the spotlight an issue that will not go away, an issue that requires a multi- and interdisciplinary approach towards determining a path forward that is legally, medically, and ultimately ethically sound, and provides for something I would imagine most, if not all, would want for themselves and their loved ones: death with dignity. In closing, a quote from Seneca, the ancient Roman philosopher, a Stoic, with a reflection on life that I think provides an important perspective on dying. Let us prepare our minds as if we'd come to the very end of life. Let us postpone nothing. Let us balance life's books each day. The one who puts the finishing touches on their life each day is never short of time. Remember, there is no health without mental health. I hope today's podcast has been enlightening. I am Professor Christopher Paul Sabo. This is Beyond Madness, in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave.